couple of new wars, they'll get along just fine.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us, Alan Aaron and Julian. In our last 10 seconds, you're coming up on 5 years in the embassy. How are you doing in the Ecuadorian embassy in London?
Well, last year, I won an epic victory against the UK government and the Swedish government at the UN. Formal ruling. It's repeated in November. Those governments still have to obey the UN. I'm being illegally detained. And I should be freed and compensated. That's according to the UN.
Julian Assange, founder and editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday to David Prude. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattas, Dina Sam Malkoff, Johnny Hamilton, Ravi Karen. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's 7:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Showers and a possible thunderstorm today with a high around 52. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Cecil and Celeste talk about the attacks on the practice of nonviolent protests with Elise Lane from the Article 20 Network. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Fran Michel. Fran, I'm so sorry about mispronouncing your name earlier. Fran Michel hosts, and the topics include Trump's foreign policy, TriMet's new budget, and love under capitalism. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. She looks at the inner life of cats, the science and secrets of our mysterious feline companions. At 11 on Health Watch, we hear from the author of An Inside Job, and we present steps to pursue physical, emotional, and spiritual healing from cancer. Radio Zine is on at 11:30, and we talked to Dr. Lauren Olson, of the author of Finally Out, Letting Go of Living Straight, his story of evolving sexuality and coming out as gay later in life. All of this because of KBOO's generous support of its members. And if you're not one, please become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. This program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from the Oregon Symphony, presenting an evening with ukulele performer and composer Jake Shimabukuru. Tickets for this ukulele concert with Jake Shimabukuro at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall on May 23rd are available now at OregonSymphony.org. That's orsymphony.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radical Ecology Night, Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Radical Ecology Night features a screening of the documentary film Weed Eater and a presentation by the Pollinator Collective called The Birds and the Bees, Why They Are Dying and What You Can Do to Help. Again, that's Radical Ecology Night, Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Hey, this is LeVar Howard over here at OSP, and I'm a part of the Yuhuru Salsa Cultural Club. And I just want to remind everybody, check us out, April 10th, Prison Pipeline.
Hey, this is Harold. We held our annual talent show here at OSP. What you're going to hear is you're going to hear an eclectic sound of music. You're going to hear some acoustic. You're going to hear some rap. You're going to hear some fun times. You're going to hear some people do some things close to their heart. And you're going to hear some things to ride to and have a good time to. So it's going to be on Prison Pipeline, April 10th, 6:30 p.m.
Prototype. Prototype, call it the volume one, call it the overnight, call it what you want to call it. I can't call it wrong or right, man. It's on a tightness of prototype testing. Testing 1, 2, 3, man. I'm
Good day. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 Corvallis, Albany area, KBOO.fm via the World Wide Web. And this is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott, and I wish you a good day. Joining us this morning is Elise Lane, who is an Oakland-based writer and blogger, originally from Buffalo, New York. She's obtained her education at Howard and studied English literature and has a doctor of philosophy from UCLA and is a lawyer. And why we are pleased to have her here is to talk about political issues. She's the author of a blog, Coming In From the Cold. And in recent weeks, we have been talking about how the resistance to the current political climate is taking place. And she is the type of person that we wanted to talk about to give some meaning and perspective on what is taking place and the limits of protesting, protests that is extending to many communities in many ways. So we are pleased to have her with us today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. And perhaps we might begin by talking about something that many people here in the States assume was a right guaranteed by the First Amendment, and about the freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech.
Right.
How has that understanding, well, first, has that a freedom to assembly always been challenged by authorities to limit that?
Well, courts have, over the centuries, really limited that very important right. So the freedom of assembly was understood by the founding fathers as entailing disruption, right? As understanding that people had the right to disrupt, to go into the streets, to be in public spaces, in order to make their views known to the government, to express their dislike for particular policies. And so it was not conceived of as simply, you know, something that was to be done in a very, you know, non-threatening way. So over the years, the courts have narrowed that right so that what we have now is a permit process. And even that is being challenged by many states, specifically states that we call red states.
I was intrigued by how you defined it as the founding fathers thought that people had a right to disrupt.
Right. So think about the revolution, right, and the Tea Party and so forth. That was, you know, they wanted to make sure that people, when they had to, when they were able to petition their government, that it's not to say violence, right? Violence is different from disruption. Disruption is, for example, blocking the freeway,
yes,
right, or creating a situation in public space that the government has to take notice. And so the Tea Party, it was, you know, that was a disruptive event, and it was understood by the founding fathers that right. That right to be in public space in ways that challenge the government had to be protected. Now we have these very narrowly defined laws that say, oh, you have to, you know, you have to get a permit. You have to do it in a specific place, specific manner, specific time.
Yes.
And again, so what we see is an attack on even the narrow right to peaceful assembly that we have. And I wanted to make sure that I circled back. You mentioned freedom of speech, and it's important to understand that part of the problem that we're dealing with is that the courts have folded the freedom of speech and the freedom of assembly and the freedom of association into each other, so that while the freedom of speech is oftentimes a part of the freedom of assembly, of peaceful assembly. Often, you know, the right to assembly is a separate right in and of itself. And so that, you know, the point may be to assemble, and that's what we want to be able to protect. Sometimes the point is to be in public space in ways that are disruptive, and not necessarily simply to express a particular, not simply to exercise speech rights.
And I'm intrigued by that. The right to assemble in public space, and you pointed out that that has been narrowed increasingly. You know, in terms of things like you have to have a permit. There's
right.
So-called in many political campaigns or conventions, you see freedom of speech zones. So there's a certain
right.
place, and it seems to me it becomes almost a corruption of the idea, and just to have the name, but it isn't exactly freedom of assembly. So for people, freedom of assembly meant that people could gather in a public space, and they have a right to do that. It seems like as if all these restrictions and hoops you have to jump through is a denial of the concept of freedom of assembly in many places.
Exactly. And part of the narrowing has to do with the law and order, the idea that, you know, we need to make sure that, you know, people were worried about violence
mm-hmm.
or what they thought might get into violent situations. And so a sort of law and order framework has been imposed upon the freedom of assembly. Sometimes because, like I said, some assemblies were violent, but often because what governments want to do is narrow people's ability to occupy public space in order to make themselves heard by their government. And it's important to understand that freedom of assembly is freedom of a peaceable assembly, and that is guaranteed not only by our Constitution, but by the United Nations. The Article 20, it's a human right that we mm-hmm. we have, and that's part of the UN framework.
We're speaking with Elise Lane, Oakland-based writer and blogger, and human rights activist, if I may call you that.
you may.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we invite you with questions or comments as we talk about the freedom of assemblies and the restriction that is taking place in many communities. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. Related to the freedom of assembly, many people witness the attempt, as we attempt to gather in public spaces, the increased
right.
militarization of the police and the intimidation that takes place. So you have groups of people gathering, and you have this militarized force up against them. What is that? Why is that taking place? Is that to make it more difficult or to assemble peacefully?
Well, let me say this. The freedom to peaceably assemble. One could argue that not only does it impose upon those of us who gather the obligation and duty to assemble peaceably, but it also imposes upon the state a duty not to bring violence to
yes.
Assemblies. So what you see, I think, is in many ways our assembly rights are treated, our assembly in public spaces is treated as always already criminal,
yes.
right? That there is, you know, so what you have are these military police coming, bearing down on people who are peaceably assembled and actually bringing violence to peaceful gatherings. Now, I would argue that this clearly dovetails with policing in poor communities, and especially poor African-American communities. And let me give you an example of what I mean. When the DOJ investigated the Baltimore Police Department, they found a pattern and practice of unconstitutional searches, stops, and arrests, and particularly of African Americans, right?
Yes.
And one particular example stands out. There was an officer who, and I'm just going to quote this, stopped to engage an African American man and his 4-year-old son, who were sitting on a fence by a playground where the young boy had been playing. The officer told them that they couldn't just stand around and that they needed to move. Now, what you have in this particular situation, but I assume that it is happening across the country, is that law enforcement agencies have been treating poor African Americans and other poor folk as if their very existence in public space is criminal.
Yes.
So you can see that that kind of thinking bleeds into how law enforcement addresses public assemblies, particularly those that are petitioning the government. So what you have is, of course, people occupying public spaces as individuals is always already criminal. And now you're going to treat people who are petitioning their government. So African Americans haven't even gotten to the point of assembling in public yes. just to, you know, petition the government. They just can't walk the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that translates into, I think, how law enforcement challenges particular kinds of assemblies. One could argue that the Women's March, for example, was not that kind of assembly. And we can talk about it in terms of a top-down politics and what it means in terms of who gets to assemble and who doesn't. But we need to think really hard, I think, about how violations of Fourth and Fifth and 14th Amendment rights, due process and equal protections, and violations in poor communities are brought to bear on law enforcement practices at certain protests.
Yes. We're speaking with Elise Lane of the Article 20 Network. Article 20, as all of us know, is from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the universal declaration that people have a right to assemble peaceably, and also the First Amendment of the United States. That
That's
right. is not so in so many communities. And as you pointed out, and you know, young men and boys, Black, I'm thinking like Black and brown young men and boys gather, you know, going to school, and then you have, you know, police questioning them just because they're there. And that's
right.
Well, we have a couple of callers, 503-231-8187 and Camilio. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you very much for this important and timely discussion. And I have two comments. One, I'm really surprised to hear Elise say that disruptive assembly is guaranteed by the Constitution. And I would like to have a citation and to know whether there's any case law that supports that. And if not, what sort of challenges have there been to the efforts of states to limit it?
So it's not that it's guaranteed. It's that there's a history that has transformed our right to be in public in disruptive ways. It has narrowed it to, you know, one has to now be peaceful in ways that the state, by in the terms that the state defines it. So what you've had is this narrowing. And courts would say, you know, of course you can't be disruptive, or I should say that states are trying to define disruption as itself a problem, that I think the time, manner, and all kinds of restrictions that you have on peaceful assemblies are such that they're trying to contain disruption.
Well, has that been challenged legally in a constitutional process? It would seem to me that if what you're saying is historically true, that there's grounds for a constitutional case.
Yes, well, there have been historical challenges. You know, I mean, it's been challenged all along, but the Supreme Court has over, you know, the decades allowed the states to continue to narrow that. So they're fine with the time, place, and manner restrictions, I think the closest it came to actually being challenged is during the Civil Rights Movement. If you remember, Southern states, Southern officials often prohibited assemblies outright or harassed folks who assembled, and they harassed them with criminal law or, of course, with violence. And so you had a pushback from the Warren Court, and it's the Warren Court that, the courts out in the 1950s and 60s that began to sort of put time, place, and manner restrictions on the freedom of assembly without, in ways that allowed that disruption, right? So what you had in civil rights protests, they were always already disruptive because of the fact that black folks gathered in the street, right?
So when I'm standing on a street corner and a police tells me to move on, what can I tell the police officer to cite that, no, I have the right to be here? Other than just the Constitution itself.
So the freedom of assembly, we have to think about it in terms of groups, right? So it's not as if you have assembled as one person, right? But it is to say that you have the right to occupy public space. Now, it depends on, are you trespassing? There are laws and trespassing laws and so forth that prevent you from just standing anywhere, right? But you have a constitution, right? Because they don't have any, it would be one of those Fourth Amendment violations of stopping you, right? An unconstitutional stop. Have you done something that is actually suspicious?
I understand. Criminal. And let me move on, right, and make just one more comment. I was at a training yesterday given by Portland Rising Tide on, right, nonviolent direct action. And what I thought that your program was going to be about was about the attacks on nonviolence from within the progressive movement, that there are more and more protests that we're seeing that really are violent. And I wanted to hear some discussion of that, because I'm afraid there really is not enough discussion within the progressive movement of resistance that it must be nonviolent.
Well, let's be clear about what we mean by nonviolence, right? So,
yes.
So disruption is not necessarily violence, and nonviolence itself has been co-opted by the state in ways that we have often capitulated to, right? So that protests have to be a certain way, you have to have a certain kind of. People take on this notion of, well, it has to be, done in a particular peaceful way. That's not nonviolence. Nonviolence is itself a challenge to the state. And it presupposes that you are going to be disruptive to business as usual. And we have internalized a more state-defined definition, which means that, oh, we don't want to disturb businesses. We don't want to not get in the streets. Now, violence coming from certain protests, that is a problem. There's nothing to protect that, right? We are bound to be peacefully assembled. But that conversation, the conversation that needs to take place is, what do we mean by nonviolence? What do we mean by nonviolent protest? And are we co-opting, are we taking on the state's co-optation of nonviolence in the way in which we frame our particular protests?
I would appreciate you offering some references on that subject.
Okay, thank you, Camilio. I thank you for steering this conversation in this direction.
You're welcome.
So how do we define nonviolence? People, it means different things to different people. So for you, what is the philosophy of nonviolence? What is it about humanity or society that makes it possible or necessary?
Those are huge questions. Well, let me give you examples so I can parse this out a little bit more. So, for example, during Ferguson and a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests, you had a lot of state officials, and including Obama, coming up and telling people that they needed to be nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
And what these state officials meant was that these people should not disrupt, should not be disruptive to business, should not be violent, which is fine. That's a way of talking about nonviolence, right? You shouldn't be violent. You shouldn't loot, and you shouldn't riot, right? And that's what part of how they were trying to frame it. But it then became something that we internalized as, oh yeah, we're not supposed to be we don't want to be nonviolent, right? Yes. And nonviolence itself as a philosophy is really one that puts you at odds with not only personal violence but also political violence. Mm-hmm. And that may require that we come up against the state on a regular basis. It may require that we go into the streets and disrupt traffic. It may require that we prevent businesses from opening because we want to understand. For example, it doesn't make any sense to ask people who have been killed by the police on a regular basis to somehow not be disruptive to business as usual. So the kind of conversations that we have to be about, well, what is nonviolence? What are we talking about when we say nonviolence? Are we saying not violent? Or are we talking about pushing against the system in political and personal violence? And that's what I would say, you know, that's how I would frame it, in thinking about nonviolence as more of a political challenge and a personal challenge. And that may require that we get on the line and go to jail.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you are in Points East along the Columbia River Gorge, and in the Willamette River Valley, it's 104.3 everywhere, KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil, myself, Celeste, and we have welcomed Elise Lane from Article 20 Network to talk about protest and the narrowing definitions as well as the narrowing scope of allowed definitions, actual protest. I've been quietly listening here, and one of the things that I think would really be helpful is to maybe kind of parse out some of the words and play a bit of semantics here. When we talk about violence, and not so much you, as I think it's our perception of what nonviolence has morphed into. What we I think are talking about nowadays is disruption and destruction. And understandably, and you kind of pointed this out very early at the beginning, is that we don't want to see destruction of private property. And I'm not saying that we all feel that way, because sometimes maybe for some people, destruction of private property is an issue, especially if private entities have co-opted public spaces. So I can see how there is a shift even in that direction. But with regard to disruption, I want to pick a couple of examples where progressive people disrupted something and were told that they needed to wait their turn. And that's that was within a whole scope of protest, and then also with the everyday kind of every person disruption that people are talking about. Now, the first disruption was the way we were introduced to Black Lives Matter when they disrupted the Bernie Sanders campaign and celebration in Seattle by making a protest that stood in the way of somebody else's agenda. You know, I've got this plan, I'm trying to move ahead, and you take the microphone and won't give it away. And so that kind of scares people, because not only of the internal churn that it creates and the calling for accountability, there's also then you take it away from that smaller stage and you put it on a bigger stage that I think Jefferson and others were imagining when they were looking at how to put peaceful protest and the guarantee of voices being heard into the Constitution. They were thinking about more of that that disruption that occurs in public spaces that have possibly been co-opted by private entities, and public spaces just to decry policy, you know. And I think what's happening with us is that we have parsed out what protest means in so many different ways and what nonviolence means in so many different ways. You got people's heads spinning right now, not us personally, but, you know, trying to understand, well, what is protest, number one? What is nonviolent, number two? How have they changed from what it used to be? And what does that mean to us now in the way things are being separated. And then also I heard you speaking about the folding in of three distinct elements of human query and accountability in this country with association and assembly, speech, and there was one more. I lost it.
But assembly, speech, yeah. Assembly, speech, and association. Those are the three.
Oh, okay. I did say them. Right. Good. Okay. So, you know, by folding them in, that further confuses us when right. we look at how we're trying to define this. So when I listen to what Camellia was saying, I'm thinking, well, he's good to narrow it down with respect to what's happening in the progressive area. But I want to point out that people have gotten so confused about what protest and nonviolence is. Red states, who were the birthplace in many ways for the Tea Party, used right. this same protest. They also, to a smaller degree, were subject to being, you know, narrowed and curtailed, but sure. they're not protecting that very right that they use. And that's how confused we have become. Is that making sense to you?
I would also say that they're confused, right? So
yes.
it's not uncommon to have people, when they talk about freedom of assembly, they immediately talk about it in terms of, they immediately talk about it in terms of speech.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I have a 4-year-old. So this is one of those moments, like when the child came into the room.
Right. Oh yeah, well we call that life nowadays.
So I had to pause. I didn't lose my train of thought. So you know, I think that they're confused also. But it's a confusion that we need to begin to talk specifically and articulately about the freedom of assembly and hearken back to that history, but also to be critical of the ways in which the courts have framed it and also talk about it in terms of law and order, right? We're not trying to maintain order, and people should be worried, and people should be uncomfortable, because what we're doing is highlighting some problems with our governments, right?
Yes.
And so that discomfort is part of what makes a democracy. And so we have to be more articulate about those rights. We have to speak of them separately, and we have to begin to litigate them separately, to be quite honest, in ways that challenge the ways the courts have framed it. And so the confusion is all out there. I wouldn't say it's just a matter of the left. I think the right also is
yes.
unclear about it.
Exactly.
But right now what we have is now that lack of clarity is being used by folks in red states to even further narrow our rights, right? And so one of the things we have to be very clear about is that the conflation of speech and assembly is also a problem in terms of what they're narrowing. So they're narrowing speech and they're narrowing assembly.
We're speaking with Elise Lane, a writer and activist out of the Oakland area. And if you have comments as we continue our conversation on the world we find ourselves living in, give us a call at 503-231-8187 and pose your question or comment. I'm wondering if you could define some of the restrictions or limits that are taking place in state legislatures that will curtail our freedom of assembly.
I'll speak of Minnesota in particular, because that's where Article 20's energy is really focused on right now. Minnesota has three bills. One was House Bill 55 and Senate Bill 148. And that was introduced in January 2017 in the House and January 17 in the Senate. And that would increase penalties for protesters who intentionally obstruct traffic. And under that bill, to obstruct traffic would be a gross misdemeanor, and it would be punishable up to a year in jail and a $3,000 fine. Mm. It would also be considered public nuisance, which would also likely be punishable as a gross misdemeanor. And so what they've, they've taken our disruption, that assembly in the streets to disrupt traffic as a way of wanted to criminalize that act. Mm-hmm. There's also a bill introduced in the House on the 23rd of January, House Bill 390. And what that would do is stiffen penalties for protests that obstruct highways and access to airports or public transit system. And it would make the offense a gross misdemeanor. That would allow prosecutors to also seek a $3,000 fine and 1 year of jail time. And then there is one that was introduced on February 2nd, and that's Bill 322, and that would allow the state to sue protesters and charge them for the cost of policing a public assembly. So you would get the right permits, you would assemble, and whatever costs they feel you incurred, they would you would be charged for. So
now,
you don't know what
there,
that is.
Isn't there also a provision in one of these bills that your property could be seized?
That might not be the specific state.
But
I would not be surprised. And so, you know, what you have is, again, they're using criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
One, they're trying to criminalize protests.
Yes.
And two, they're trying to make money off of it, right? So it's a very neoliberal framework, right? So let's make money off of it at the same time that of this right that should be readily available to all of us. Let's make money through our penalties. So these are what we're focusing on. We're trying to get the Minnesota governor to take a strong stand on assembly rights, on the freedom of assembly, because this is what this is attacking. And it's like I said, it certainly has its roots in the 1950s, 1960s Southern strategies.
Well, it's similar legislation recorded or made in the Southern states during the 60s. That's what I think you're saying?
Well, that Southern politicians would enjoin assemblies. They would, of course, allow violence and be perpetrators of violence at assemblies. But they would also develop legislation to criminalize. And so, the civil rights movement, folks, organizations had to go to court on a regular basis to push back on this. We're not in the context of a Warren court. We're in the context of a Roberts Alito court.
Yes.
So it's particularly frightening what they're trying to do.
I hope our listener heard in terms of your historical overview of the pushback that civil rights groups had to do in the 50s and 60s because of the attempt to limit their ability to assemble and protest. There's, I think, a notion or mythology that has developed over the civil rights movement that they the good protesters were like marching behind ministers and singing "We Shall Overcome,"
and picking up their trash as they walk.
As they walk, and oftentimes these days, we have that contrast that I think Camilio hinted towards in terms of good protesters and bad protesters.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, so you had the good protesters, for example, were at the Women's March, which I think it was a fantastic march. It's not to put that down, but it is to talk. But and of course the Black Lives Matter are the bad marches, or the Occupies were the bad assemblies, right? Part of how we have to think about this is in terms of bottom up politics, right? The real class and race issues that come into play in defining who the good protester is and who isn't. We play into that when we sort of police each other around those things. Instead of having a robust conversation about assembly rights, we instead have a conversation about how we're behaving at these particular rallies and whether we're being good protesters or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not one who advocates for violence. But I absolutely, positively advocate for disruption. And we need to have conversations with folks and deal with people's fears around disruption. But also understanding that we get vilified for disruption, right? Yes. So,
but we're going to be vilified anyway, and I think that's an important thing for us to remember. There is no do it nice, because if you are if you're vilified as an entity, there is nothing good you can do. Nothing you do will be transmuted to acceptable except remain docile and not be seen.
Right.
That's the only thing. So if we're going to protest, just recognize that whatever way you do it, it has to be with conscience, and it has to be well, I'm going to put it in as I look at and folks translate it into whatever your schema of personal control is, but I'm going to say by morals, you know, and make sure that whatever I'm doing makes as clear a statement as I can that this is what I'm upset about and this is what I think the solution should be. Because sometimes this protest that we try to label as good and bad is like, well, if you destroy somebody's private property, that's bad. But again, what if that property is something that's been co-opted from the public?
Well, you know, this is the other thing, too. I mean, I think the model of the 50s and 60s is not a model we should follow. And, and I'm going to say it. The reason I'm going to say that is because when we look at how the protesters are protesting, we talk about picking up trash or whatever. There's nothing wrong with
that. Well, I meant facetiously, but yeah, you're right.
Well, I know. But I think those the 50s and 60s. When we talk about we forget about the context, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that we forget about the everyday violence in the public sphere against African Americans. So that even gathering on the corner, you have to step aside because a white person is walking down the street. So the audacity to come together in the streets to march was amazing to these Southerners, and it was a direct confrontation. And so what we see, these men and women dressed in their Sunday best. And that was for a particular context, a particularly violent context. And so it's not to say that we still can't do that, but it doesn't translate and doesn't mean the same thing. But increasingly, you know, as the states and city legislatures try to adopt restrictive rules around assembly, that may in fact start to look the same, be the same.
We're speaking with Elise Lane of the Article 20 Network. We're speaking about how we confront the, and you fill in the blank, machine. How is resistance possible? Tell us something about what is different about these times from the 60s in terms of way, expand that conversation a little bit more in terms of how people might critically think about nonviolent protests. And again, we need to unearth what we mean by nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we need to start thinking about it in terms of the neoliberal paradigm, right? And the ways in which public space is being more and more defined as the purview of private interests. And so that what we're seeing is being as pushback against the neoliberal paradigm.
Yes.
That is really determining a lot of how protesters are seen. They're interrupting business.
Yes.
They're inconveniencing us, right?
Right.
And they're costing us money,
right?
So that it's never an issue of what the government is doing, or even what businesses are doing, for that matter. Mm-hmm. It's an issue of its inconvenience and it's hitting our pocketbooks,
yes.
Right? That's how they're getting framed. And so, and then these people are lazy. They're all lazy in the street. They don't have jobs, right?
Right.
So they get framed in those terms as well. But in terms of, so I think we need to come to terms with that different framework. And I'm not sure that we have enough conversation about what it means to push back against, to talk about the neoliberal paradigm as the subject of our protest and as something that we need to be more articulate about. So I think that that's part of how we, and that's happening worldwide, right? And so I think we need to be more articulate about that and how we frame nonviolence.
So how can we even begin this conversation since we're having to deal with a fracturing not only of what these words have come to mean, but the context of the times? You know, like, for example, when you're describing how black people dressed in their Sunday best were trying to put a respectable and intelligent face on protests, even though it, you know, it didn't necessarily matter to those folks. Well, we don't have those kind of customs now to put that kind of I don't know, what would we call it, a civilized veneer or whatever, you know, on protest to help people recognize. We don't, because it seems that so much of how we view society is fractured. So how do we even begin to have a conversation to define these elements and then be able to focus on a way to have a protest that lands in the bullseye of what our concern is? Is that making sense?
Yeah, I hope I'm answering it in ways that make sense. So one, we have to have the conversations in our organizing. I think that's true. And two, that there is now a protest script. You know, it kind of plays out. You know what how a protest is going to unfold. You know how a rally is going to unfold. So there's ways in which we're kind of stuck in this. A lot of folks are stuck in doing it the way it's always been done.
Yes.
So there has to be a serious conversations around tactics. What's new and this is and promising is the kind of protests we saw at the airports. Right. It's almost like flash mobs.
Yes.
Word of mouth that everybody was showing up at the airports when the Muslim ban was put in place by Trump, and I think that is a really interesting turn, because it wasn't permit based. It was, you know, word of mouth. People showed up and then they were gone.
Yes.
And so that's a really powerful difference. And I think we ought to push against. You know, I really do think we should begin to challenge the permit process in ways that reinvigorate our right for peaceful assembly. So we need to have conversations about that and really start to parse ourselves what the differences are in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly. Because part of it is we're operating from ignorance, right? We're not having that kind of conversation. And so I think what's happening now amongst the left in these community organizing, anti-Trump organizing, is very promising in terms of having these conversations, but we need to be wary of, you know, constantly doing the same script. You know how it's going to go. So why are we not challenging the script that we've written?
Oh, excellent. I wish we... Oh,
yes. Yes. So, we need more conversations just like that on that point. Yes.
So coming up on this morning on KBOO, at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Guests from Foreign Policies on Focus discuss Trump's foreign policy. Opal Environmental Justice talks about TriMet's new budget plus love under capitalism. At 10 is Chris Andre, who hosts Air Cascadia Headlines News and Commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. Look at the inner life of cats, the science and secrets of our mysterious feline companions. At 11, Health Watch hears from the author of Inside Job and present steps to pursue physical, emotional, and spiritual healing from cancer. At 11:30, Radio Zine talks to Dr. Lauren Olson, the author of Finally Out, Letting Go of Living Straight, his story of evolving sexuality, coming out as gay later in life. Thank you, KBOO members and supporters. If you'd like to be one, go to kboo.fm and donate. And we're speaking here on More Talk Radio with Elise Lane of the Article 20 Network.
You know, we don't have enough time to even begin to cover this, given the fact that we kind of started off handicapped with the fact that nonviolent has changed its connotations and even denotations, and right. and so has protest. But I like the way you said to, you know, to the listeners, look, change the script. Look at new ways of protest and find out what has been working and has captured the imagination of right. both the opposition and has excited the imagination of allies. So right. one of the things that I want to encourage people, whether they are conservative or progressive or left or right or whatever, is to pay attention to how this right is being limited across the board. Because earlier when I started talking, I was mentioning how the Tea Party protesters in the Tea Party infancy, they were in force and they were quite disruptive. And right. they've forgotten how powerful that was for them, because they're very happy to shut down what is going to end up being their own right to protest. You That's know? Right. And so, I'm looking at the swearing in, the confirmation of Judge Gorsuch, and here we have a man who calls himself an originalist, who wants to make the Constitution be supported the way it was originally meant. So I'm looking at this, and I'm listening to you, and I'm laughing because I'm thinking, okay, we're about to see a change-up occur. Because right. when it comes to, again, this narrowing of the application and even definition of freedom of assembly, of association, and of speech, this man can't possibly be a originalist with regard to the where the court is going and changing this, can he?
Right.
He's going to have to change
right.
up, isn't he?
Right. Well, you know, I think there are sincere originalists, but I think for the most part, the you know, originalism is just an excuse to maintain the status quo.
Yes, it is. I'm not fooled.
Absolutely. So he, you know, his rise to the court is does not bode well for what we're facing, and that's something that we also have to, you know, just be ready for. One of the things I just wanted to back up before I forget this point, you know, around nonviolence, that part of rethinking nonviolence, I think, has to entail going back to thinking about it in terms of a personal political practice, so that we have to start thinking about activism as including our everyday lives. So, and that to me, as I argue in my book Nonviolence Now, is critical to rethinking and repositioning ourselves vis-a-vis violence, not only in our communities, in our homes, but also the violence of the state. And that itself must be part of the process of transforming our relationship and our thinking around nonviolent protest.
So if people want to get grounded and figure out a good way to start a community conversation about how to define nonviolence, how to define protest, so that we know how to push back and protect our rights, one of the first things we want to do is read your book, right?
Well, I would love for you to read my book. You can also go onto the Article 20 Network, and we've put together a nonviolence pledge, and that's based on, and my book and the pledge is based on what happened during the Birmingham campaign, 1963. It's a little known fact, but and Martin Luther King talks about it in Why We Can't Wait, but volunteers for the movement were required to sign a pledge.
Yes.
And there were 10 things that they promised to do. They made a personal commitment to nonviolence. And the 10 commitments were like, you know, pray daily, treat your neighbors with respect, that kind of thing. I can't think about it off the top of my head. But they were personal practices of nonviolence in which the organizers were to ground themselves in as they went into the streets to confront power. And I think that is an important component that got lost through the whole idea of nonviolence merely as strategies and tactics.
Yes.
What does it mean to practice nonviolence on an everyday basis, and what does that mean in terms of your relationship to the state, your relationship to the community? You're thinking, you're transforming yourself into somebody who is necessarily going to always already be in opposition to the kind of violence that manifests in our society. So that has to change our perspective. It has to change our tactics, and even our approach to how we confront power. And so we can have those conversations. Go to Article 20 Network's website. There's a pledge form that we put together, a pledge to nonviolence that I think would be an interesting conversation starter for groups that are wanting to have those conversations and start to think about nonviolence a little bit more, with a little bit more
Well, clarity.
Depth and clarity, yes. Depth and clarity.
And then finally, one more thing I want to touch, because I did mention it and I want to try to qualify it. When I talked about the fact that sometimes we end up with some measure of property destruction because you find that public spaces have been co-opted and made private, I want to reference, and all of a sudden the name totally disappeared for me, but it was the very recent protest regarding water rights. And
are you talking about the North Dakota
Standing Rock? There we go. It came back. Yes. Right. Now that's an instance where what you're saying about having to have a very clear framework of and definition of what you will and won't do with regard to protests and nonviolence is important, because what you saw is a population under duress and under physical attack, who stood their ground and did not return violence for violence.
Right.
And that was very difficult, and that was life-threatening. And that's also an example of what I mean when I said sometimes it's necessary to really understand what you're protesting for, because you may end up doing some form of quote-unquote property damage, whether it's a false claim or, you know, a claim that's just been kind of created by law but not by reality. Mm-hmm. And you have to be willing to put it down, so to speak. You know, you got to put your life out there. Now, for people who are at that level and recognizing that, how would you suggest they help get the word out and reach out to organizations or people who are not quite that sophisticated and not at that level yet?
Oh, that's a big. I couldn't begin to answer that question, but I think that what they've done was instructive to all of us, mm-hmm. In terms of how we need to put our bodies in line. Peaceful, to assemble peaceably does not necessarily mean that we aren't going to confront violence. It's not safe. We're not being safe. Mm-hmm. And so part of how we talk about things is that, oh, you know, we need to be safe. No, the whole point is you're putting yourself and you're putting your body on the line. People, and what I loved about those protests is that people were migrating from all over the world,
yes.
To converge here, and that convergence is precisely the kind of politics that we need. So that one is to study what they've done, but also participate, to talk to people about, to exchange ideas around how that happened, and to really just start to connect and fine tune what you're doing in your own community. That's the only thing I can suggest. I wish I had the answer to that.
Well, you gave us a ground, you know, a grounding, and that's what we needed to hear.
And when people, you know, locally, there are many groups and organizations here in Portland who are practice and live nonviolence, and mm-hmm. I want to help encourage the conversation you mentioned in terms of, you know, what is different is this neoliberalism that has taken a hold of all of us and shaped our way of thinking, and to think critically about that and about our tactics and our philosophy in confronting this beast.
Exactly. You know, in ways in which our rights are being redefined. I mean, across the board, our rights are being redefined for the benefit of corporate interests.
Yes.
And that is really, so part of the policing in African American communities really is to deal with, has to do with, you know, the failures of our system in terms of capitalism, in terms of, you know, our government mentality. It's their failures, and this is how they're managing failures.
Thank you so much. This has been More Talk Radio. We have been speaking with Elise Lane of the Article 20 Network about how to redefine protest nonviolence to make it work in today's times. Thank you so much, and we'll be visiting you again.
That would be fantastic. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Everybody, have a good day. Start those conversations. Redefine, recenter, so we can re-energize ourselves. This is your community connection, hoping to spark that new wave of energy. And we want you to stay tuned in. 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in Points East, 104.3 Points South, and everywhere, KBOO.FM.
Good morning, it's 8:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Fran Michelle hosts, and topics include Trump's foreign policy, TriMet's new budget, and love under capitalism. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard event series happening monthly at the Old Church in Portland. This month, it takes place on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. This month, We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard features Grammy-nominated recording artist Julianne Johnson, organizer of the Portland Women's March, Margaret Jacobson, musician and millennial Mo Lincoln, and Rwandan facilitator of storytelling, Solange Iponoyimana. Again, that's We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard, Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radical Ecology Night, Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Radical Ecology Night features a screening of the documentary film Weed Eater and a presentation by the Pollinator Collective called The Birds and the Bees, Why They Are Dying and What You Can Do to Help. Again, that's Radical Ecology